once.
"Miss Speedwell? Mr. Templeton Vane? Horace Steele?"
said the taller of the two coming towards us, hand outstretched. I took it, and he shook mine warmly, holding it in the firm, friendly grasp I had so often noted amongst Americans. He was of medium height, but slim, and his wiry build, coupled with a shock of white hair standing on end, made him seem much taller. His brows and moustaches were snowy and luxuriant, his blue eyes bright with interest. He bore a strong resemblance to the Yankee author known as Mark Twain, and he seemed the sort of man who would always find a way to enjoy himself. His companion was decidedly more subdued, of a similar height to Mr. Steele. The other man was easily half his age, with a markedly sturdier build. His demeanour was watchful and quiet, and he held a book in his hand, a study of drains and effluent matter in the capital cities of Europe.
"Henry Steele,"
he said, coming forwards with obvious reluctance. He might have been the great man's son, but he bore little resemblance to him, and I wondered what kind of woman Mrs. Steele had been. He wore clothes of obviously expensive make that had probably been well tailored, but they were so heavily creased and crumpled it was impossible to tell. His hair resembled the plumage of a disheveled porcupine, and there were ink stains upon his fingers.
"You are interested in drains, Mr. Steele?" I asked brightly with a glance at his book.
His expression was grave.
"It is a subject which ought to interest us all, I think. It is only by the application of proper engineering and sanitation methods that we can hope to halt the spread of some of the most virulent diseases that currently plague us. Your own city of London provides the most instructive study. Did you know there are entire underground rivers flowing beneath our feet at this very moment?"
I blinked at him in surprise. It is seldom that a gentleman raises the subject of sewage so early in a conversation, I reflected. His father seemed not at all shocked. He merely gave a long-suffering sigh.
"Henry,"
he said with firm authority,
"no drains, not now."
The young man flushed to the roots of his hair.
"Perhaps we can resume the topic at a different time," I suggested.
He gave an indifferent shrug, and I wondered if it was the fate of the Tiverton and Steele children to be overshadowed by their charismatic fathers. The introductions complete, Horace Steele waved us to chairs and began the conversation with a directness that was typically American.
"What can I do for you?"
he asked, his expression genial but wary. No doubt the great man spent the bulk of his time fending off fortune hunters, rapscallions, and wastrels, who would always linger about those with money, hoping to pick up whatever crumbs they might. I gave him a disarming smile.
"It is more a question of what we can do for you," I said.
Henry Steele narrowed his eyes.
"We are not in need of any professional service at this time,"
he said shortly. His father cut him off with an abrupt gesture.
"No call to be rude, boy. We must observe the form,"
he said, with unnecessary firmness. Henry Steele flushed again, this time retreating to his book to hide his blushes. Horace Steele made apologetic noises.
"You must excuse the pup. Henry is determined to see villains behind every strange face. Now, what can you do for me?"
"We have come about the disappearance of John de Morgan," I told him.
From the tail of my eye, I could see Henry Steele's book slip. He caught it before it fell, his knuckles tightening to whiteness. He made a show of propping the book up, but during the ensuing conversation he turned not a single page.
"Sad business,"
Horace Steele was saying.
"But nothing to do with us. We never even met the fellow."
"You had a different concession this year," I ventured, "and I understand it was De Morgan's first year digging with the Tivertons."
"That's right."
Horace Steele nodded, his extraordinary halo of white hair glowing like a nimbus about his head.
Where did you dig?
Stoker asked.
Amarna,
came the prompt reply.
I thought I would have a go at finding old Akhenaten. Are you familiar with him?
Originally called Amenhotep IV, 18th dynasty, successor to Amenhotep III, I answered swiftly. Stoker stared at me in frank surprise. The fact that Lord Rosemarin's collection was bound to house some of the finest Egyptological works was something he should have deduced himself. I had read late into the night, giving myself as thorough a grounding in the subject as I could. Horace Steele gave me a look of approval, and I went on. Akhenaten founded the city of Amarna, moving the capital from Thebes and wresting power from the priests of Amun by establishing the worship of the one god, the Aten. The Aten was associated with the sun, was it not? I asked.
The sun disk,
Horace Steele said, his voice taking on a dreamy quality.
Amenhotep IV believed that the sun disk, the Aten, was the source of life. He changed his name to Akhenaten because it means the living spirit of Aten, the conduit for all life in Egypt. He created a revolution, overthrowing all that had been known of culture and religion for thousands of years. He built a new capital city and commissioned art depicting himself and his family as the recipients of the favor of the Aten. Nothing like it has ever existed before or since. Imagine that,
he instructed, sitting very straight, his eyes burning with fervid heat.
A single man uprooting everything his society had known with his own two hands and refashioning the world in the image of himself.
His son snorted, but when I looked, his eyes were fixed firmly on the page before him. But Horace Steele had heard it as well.
My son doesn't approve of Akhenaten. He views him as an iconoclast and a rebel. But I believe he was a forward thinker, a man ahead of his time. He changed the art and moved the capital, but he did nothing to materially alter the lives of his subjects,
Stoker objected. From behind the book came a growl of approval. Horace Steele smiled thinly.
He didn't have the chance. First, he needed to change the court and the temples. The rest would have followed in time.
From the slender book I had unearthed on the Amarna period, I knew Akhenaten's reign had spanned at least a decade, plenty of time to have allowed him to improve the life of the average Egyptian who toiled from sunup to sundown. But it would not do to contradict Horace Steele, I reflected. I shifted in my seat, bringing the point of my parasol down quietly but firmly on Stoker's booted foot, pinning it in place. How very fascinating, I murmured, batting my lashes a little. Steele looked from Stoker to me and stroked his lavish white moustaches.
And of course,
the millionaire continued,
he was most fortunate in his consort, the great royal wife.
Neph, what was it again? I asked, opening my eyes very wide and deliberately stumbling over the name.
Nefertiti,
Steele supplied promptly.
She was called the Lady of Grace and Sweet of Love, you know, among a host of other titles. She was the most honored consort in Egyptian history and the most beautiful. It is a wonderful love story. Of all the sentimental rubbish,
the younger Steele burst out, tossing his book aside.
Nefertiti was a partner, not some bit of decoration. In the temple at Karnak, she is clearly shown smiting her enemies with all the powers of a pharaoh. Now, hold on, son,
instructed the elder, holding up a hand.
I will grant you that she was his helpmeet, but presuming that she wielded the powers of a pharaoh is just nonsense, errant nonsense.
Henry Steele clutched at his hair with both hands.
Do you see what I have to endure?
He demanded of no one in particular.
I looked to his father and saw Horace Steele watching his son with a gleam in his eye. Their clashes were clearly a thing of long-standing and an obvious source of amusement, at least to the father. I hastened to pour oil on the troubled waters, as much to calm the son as to draw the father back to the point of our visit. Naturally, Amarna would offer the greatest scope for your interest in Akhenaten and Nefertiti. Was it a successful season? Henry Steele made a sound of disgust and returned to his book. His father was more composed. He stroked his moustaches thoughtfully.
Not particularly. We unearthed a pretty cache of pottery and excavated a pavement. A pavement!
Muttered Henry with some feeling. Horace Steele ignored his son.
Ours was not nearly as productive and engaging a time as was had by the Tivertons,
he remarked.
Yes, their find was extraordinary,
Soker said smoothly.
Too extraordinary,
Henry said from behind his book. Indeed? I asked, lifting my brows. Henry did not elaborate. His father gave me an apologetic smile.
Henry has been at school for several seasons, and last year was his first time in the field since he was a child. Our discoveries were less than scintillating, so that's why I decided to have a go at Amarna. I hoped we would find something to write home about this time, but I am sorry to say luck was not on our side. The boy is still resentful that we did not share the Tivertons' good fortune.
But you might have, I said, in a voice silken with insinuation. I understand they were digging on a concession you had last year.
And should have had this year,
burst out young Steele. His eyes were blazing, and a muscle in his jaw twitched furiously.
I don't know how they did it, but they secured the firman and cut us right out.
Something flickered behind the sharp blue eyes.
Now, son, Sir Leicester Tiverton is not the sort of man who would do a friend down in business,
his father said mildly.
And yet he did,
Henry Steele riposted with real bitterness.
But what could have prompted such an act?
Stoker asked. The elder Steele shrugged.
I wish I knew.
Henry Steele rose stiffly, clutching his book on drains.
Please excuse me,
he said quietly, as he fled the room. No one spoke for a long moment. The only sound was the steady ticking of the mantel clock, a hideous thing painted with Highland scenes. I cut my eyes at Stoker and flicked them quickly in the direction of the door. He rose.
Do excuse me, Mr. Steele. I'm afraid I just remembered there is a telegram I need to send.
The millionaire nodded, and Stoker took his leave, giving me a significant glance as he did so. I turned back to Mr. Steele. I must apologize. Discussing the Tivertons seems to have upset young Mr. Steele, and that was not my intention. His smile, barely visible under the lavish white fringe of his moustaches, was tired.
I have stopped keeping count of the things that upset young Mr. Steele.
I believe Miss Iphigenia Tiverton is similarly prickly, I observed mildly. His expression was one of wistful fondness.
It's a difficult thing to lose one's mother, particularly a mother as unique as Lady Tiverton.
I understand she wrote some highly regarded works on Egyptology, I told him.
That she did,
he said, his eyes gleaming.
Lucy Ward Tiverton was a miracle of a woman. Do you know she was diagnosed with consumption at the age of 19? Specialists told her she would be dead within 2 years. She lived to be more than 40 years of age, and that by the sheer force of her will. I have never known a woman who could light up a room the way she could,
he said, his voice suddenly thick with emotion. The Tivertons had mentioned Horace Steele's affection for Lucy Tiverton, but I began to wonder if his feelings had not been more significant by far. "Is Miss Iphigenia very like her mother?"
"Lord love you, no. Lucy was sharp as Toledo steel, and with eyes, great dark eyes that would look right into your heart and dare you to tell the truth. Poor Figgy takes after her father's side, both in looks and temperament. But I have high hopes she will emerge from her adolescence as a credit to the mother she has lost."
He finished gallantly. I smiled back. "Children, I am told, are both blessing and burden, long after they are grown."
"You can say that again,"
he replied, with heartfelt emotion.
"I have never understood my own boy, not from the day his mama pushed him into the world. He takes after her people, quiet, bookish folk,"
he confided.
"The Steels were doers. They carved out a place and a name for themselves in America when you Brits were cutting the heads off your kings."
"Well, we don't make a habit of it," I said. He chuckled and waved a hand.
"The point is, we Steels have got in the way of shaping our own destiny. We make our mark in the world. We take risks and damn the consequences, if you'll pardon the expression."
"I will. I am of similar bent," I assured him. He gave me an admiring look.
"The problem is, too much of that in the bloodline eventually breeds stupid."
"I beg your pardon?"
"People are like horses, Miss Speedwell. Bloodlines carry certain traits. Too much of the same kind of blood eventually breeds stupid. I had a racehorse so simple he followed a pig around because he thought they were kin. Families are the same. We Steels are fire-in-the-blood types, always up for a challenge, never backing away from a fight. But my mother was a second cousin to my father, and that was just too much of a good thing. My younger brother was so impatient, he once deliberately burned down a house just to cook a steak. I thought if I married a woman different, someone sober and refined, it would dilute some of that steel bullheadedness."
"It seems to have worked," I mused. "Mr. Henry Steele is certainly a young man of quiet tastes."
"Quiet tastes,"
he snorted.
"I have to pay him 10 whole American dollars just to get him to go to a music hall and have a little fun. He's sober as a parson, and half as interesting. I just wish he would put the damn books down and live a little, if you'll pardon the expression,"
he added hastily. "Certainly. But you are fortunate, Mr. Steele. Your son takes an interest in your travels and excavations. Surely that is something you can share." He shrugged.
"I suppose. But the bloom has gone off the rose a bit. I had the devil's own time getting him out to Egypt this year. I don't know as he will want to go back again."
"Why?" I pried gently. But for all his expansive habits of conversation, Horace Steele could be close as an oyster. He gave me a bland smile.
"I have bored you too long with discussions of my family. You are a sympathetic listener, Miss Speedwell."
I batted my lashes and did a few other revoltingly female things, but the moment for confidences was past. Knowing when to surrender the field, I rose. "Thank you for seeing us, Mr. Steele." He took the hand I offered, holding it carefully in his own as if it were a precious object.
"The pleasure has been entirely mine, Miss Speedwell. I am only sorry I could not help with your search for Mr. De Morgan."
I paused, then seized the chance for one last desperate throw of the dice. "Mr. Steele, if you know anything at all, I should consider it a personal favor if you would tell me. It might help us to discover the truth behind Mr. De Morgan's disappearance and offer some consolation to his grieving wife." Horace Steele flinched a little at the mention of a grieving wife. He was, as his son had pointed out, a sentimental man, and I had pressed ruthlessly upon that vulnerable point. But he merely shook his head.
"I wish you every success,"
he replied obliquely. Defeated, but determined to be gracious, I went to the door, followed closely by Mr. Steele, who insisted upon opening it himself.
"Miss Speedwell," he said, "wait here a moment."
He disappeared into his bedchamber, returning a moment later with a pair of volumes bound in identical faience blue kid. They were stamped in gold on the spines. The first was called A Lady's Adventures Upon the Nile, while the second was titled Further Adventures of a Lady Egyptologist. Both were authored by Lady Tiverton.
"Take them,"
he urged. He was quite close, and I caught the sharp, spicy scent of bay rum, warmed by the skin of his freshly barbered chin. "Mr. Steele, I couldn't possibly," I protested. He smiled.
"She was a very dear friend, and I have many copies. It would please me greatly for you to have them."
Then, in a wholly unexpected gesture, he swept a low bow and kissed my hand. I left him then, but the brush of his silken moustaches against my fingers lingered for some time. I collected Stoker from the lobby, where he was comfortably ensconced reading a newspaper article about the recent establishment of the National Geographic Society in Washington, D.C. Without letting him finish, I tossed the newspaper aside and bore him off into the gloom. "Blast this weather," I muttered, as we stepped from the lambent warmth of the hotel. "I would sell my virtue for a sunny day and a tropical trade wind." To his credit, Stoker did not point out that my virtue was no longer mine to sell. Instead, he tucked my hand in the crook of his arm and guided me down the street. We proceeded from the hotel in the direction of Bishop's Folly, neither of us inclined to summon a hansom. It was frigid and mizzling, filthy weather, but the temperature had dropped from the previous day, and the air was too cold to bear its usual stink of horse and rotting vegetables and coal smoke. It was sharp as a new blade, that air, and I drew in several lungfuls of it as we moved through the gathering shadows, pacing off our steps between the glowing pools of light from the street lamps.
"So Mr. Steele was impervious to your charms?"
he hazarded as we crossed a street behind an omnibus. "Not entirely. He was kind enough to give me copies of Lady Tiverton's Egyptian memoirs," I told him, deliberately omitting the millionaire's kiss to my hand. "He is a child in a grown man's suit, all enthusiasm and rush and forwardness. I fancy his son is exhausted."
"And prickly as a cactus."
"He has that in common with Iphigenia Tiverton," I observed. "They should form a club. Children of obstreperous parents."
"Little wonder that Steele and Tiverton got on so well for so many years. They are of a type."
"And even smaller wonder they eventually fell out," I added. "Both of them strike me as highly idealistic, extremely stubborn men. As soon as one of them conceived of a slight, he would nurse it to the grave. That sort always bears a grudge."
"But over what?"
I shrugged. "Egyptology. What else? Sir Leicester permitted simple avariciousness to come between him and his friend, as Mr. Henry Steele so acutely observed. I am only surprised his father does not admit the quarrel."
"He had no other complaints?"
"None. He was quite correct in his praise of Sir Leicester's abilities, if not his probity. And he has a soft spot for Figgy, although it is not half what he felt for her mother." Stoker nodded.
"He's the sort who would have done well with daughters. All indulgent benevolence. I pity his son."
"Do you? Is it worth pitying the sole heir of a millionaire?" Stoker snorted.
"Henry Steele will earn every penny of his inheritance, I assure you. No doubt he has totted up every slight in a ledger somewhere."
I suspect his father has caused him a great deal of embarrassment. I further suspect that Horace Steele is entirely unaware of the effect he has on his son. He is mystified by the boy. He clearly wishes he had some more dashing fellow for an heir.
Thus my pity for him. I am only too familiar with the subtle vengeances of a father on the figure of a son he does not value.
The words were spoken lightly, but a lifetime of slights rested in those few words. Stoker had amassed a collection of petty hatreds from his father, and he showed them to precious few. Deliberately I changed the subject. So, the friendship of 20 years has foundered upon Sir Leicester's avarice in claiming the tomb for himself. Is he naturally disloyal, or do you think something else prompted him? Stoker was silent for some minutes as we navigated a particularly crowded thoroughfare, turning at last into a quiet residential street bordering a private square. The trees in the square had given up their leaves, the slim black branches bearing a thin coat of ice. They stirred suddenly in a gust of wind, clicking together like the finger bones of a dead man. Stoker squeezed my hand, quite unconsciously, I thought. He spoke at last.
What if the Tivertons were short of money? Egyptology is a devilishly expensive proposition. He has a country house in Surrey, a daughter to educate and launch into society, a wife to keep. He has kept pace for 20 years with an American millionaire, underwriting his own expeditions. What if he has gone to the well once too often?
I tipped my head. That would account for his desire to keep the hoard to himself. Many a greater man has sacrificed a friend for the sake of a fortune. But there is more than just money at stake.
Fame,
Stoker supplied. Precisely. Despite the paucity of the find, this discovery will forever be known as the crowning glory of the Tiverton expeditions. It will be written in all the books and newspapers. Sir Leicester has secured himself a place in Egyptological history. Perhaps that is as great an inducement as money.
Perhaps.
We walked on for several minutes more before I could steel myself for what must come next. We have interviewed the Tivertons and Horace Steele, I began slowly. We have set Lady Wellingtonia to ferreting out any society gossip that might prove useful. And Julien d'Orland is keeping a careful eye upon the goings-on at the Sudbury. But there is one obvious stone we have not yet overturned. The arm beneath my fingers tensed.
I see no reason.
I pushed on ruthlessly. Of course you don't. You are not thinking logically. We must interview her. Caroline de Morgan is the last person to see her husband. She knows something.
She knows nothing.
His voice was harsh. You cannot say that for certain.
Sir Hugo and Mornaday both said she was in hiding.
Sir Hugo and Mornaday are, for all their gifts, merely men. They lack imagination. She is in the care of her parents.
You don't know.
I do, actually. I matched his coldness with an arctic chill of my own invention. I have confirmed that she is in London, currently residing at the home of her parents in a house in Kensington just off the Cromwell Road. He stopped dead, wrenching his arm free. He had stopped in a shadow, but his eyes blazed through the darkness.
How in the name of bleeding Jesus do you know that?
I felt my lip curl. I have my methods. It took him only a moment to work it out.
George.
He is a most obliging fellow and quite clever. It took him only an afternoon to find the house and to confirm that she is there. We must speak with her. A stillness settled over him, so complete, so encompassing that I could not reach him. He had moved 1,000 miles from me. And yet we stood half a foot apart. I could feel the warmth thrown off by his big body in the cold air, but he was as far away and forbidding as a mountain.
"I do not wish—"
"It is not about what you wish," I cut in savagely. "Caroline de Morgan might well hold the key to her husband's disappearance, and we have to clear your name. So I will see her, and I will ask her whatever questions must be asked, and I will do it with you or without you." What he said next was something so profane that no clergyman in England would have shriven him afterwards. I waited while he expounded upon his theme, calling me every name he could conceive, and a few I had never heard. "Are you quite finished?" I asked, after some minutes. I spoke the words in a tone of complete boredom, careful not to let him see that my hands were trembling.
"Quite,"
he said, biting off the word sharply. "Good. There is no time like the present," I said, turning to whistle for a hansom. Chapter 9. We settled into the cab, locked in our silences. Stoker and I had two forms of disagreement: violent and vocal discord, or completely mute hostility. Our current disaffection manifested as the latter. I knew he was enraged at my insistence, but he was more enraged that I was right. Caroline had to be faced, and the fact that he could not avoid her galled him more than anything else about this business. For my own part, I tried not to think about how desperately he must care about her to be so deeply affected. I had heard his tortured cries in nightmares. I knew she haunted him still. I had felt his lips on mine, moving to form the syllables of her name even as he pushed himself out of my embrace. I was grateful for it. Stoker and I were partners rather than lovers, but the blow to my amour propre still stung. I had forgiven him, not that he noticed. He had no memory of that aborted kiss, at least none that he had ever acknowledged by so much as a flicker of an eyelash. But he must have remembered the dreams. No man could suffer as he did and not remember when the morning came. He called her name then too, an invocation in the darkness, but she never came except as a ghost to torment him. It was a score I meant to settle with her one day, I promised myself as the hansom rattled along. I had provided the driver with the address, and Stoker did not seem surprised. "This house in Kensington," I began, in a tone of marked froideur. "I take it the place has been in her family?"
"Her father purchased it,"
he replied after a long silence.
"His family were in manufacturing in the north, something to do with plumbing supplies. Her mother is an honourable. She was the daughter of a baron before she married Marshwood."
"She married down," I observed. "Either she truly loved him, or her people had no money."
"Very much the latter,"
he said in a hollow voice. He was reciting from memory, and had no attachment to the words themselves, but I wanted to keep him talking. Anything to prevent him from thinking too much about what he must do once we arrived. "So she married with an eye to using her husband's fortune to regain lost prestige?"
"She tried. After they were married, she discovered that Mr. Marshwood's prospects were far less grand than she had been led to believe. She has devoted her life to pushing him into better circumstances."
"Why did they go to Egypt?"
"He accepted a minor diplomatic post. She used her father's connections to secure his appointment, but Marshwood was something of a disaster. He wasn't brought up to that sort of thing and bungled it frequently."
There was a casual snobbery in Stoker's remarks. The fact that Mr. Marshwood had not been born to the ermine of aristocracy did not preclude him from being a man of talent and ability. But this was not the time to brangle with Stoker. "Why did they come back to England?" Too late, I realized I had blundered. He turned his head, his smile a harsh, thin line.
"Because they needed to rescue their daughter from her brute of a husband."
"I apolo—" He held up a hand.
Don't. I may forgive you for forcing me into this, but it will not be today.
The hansom rocked to a stop, and Stoker flung a coin at the driver.
Keep the change.
That's half a crown!
The cabman protested in half-credulous joy.
I don't bloody care.
Stoker called over his shoulder as he stalked away. He mounted the steps of a stolid house, as characterless and dull as all the rest in that particular square. I followed hard upon his heels. He turned as we reached the top.
You really have no idea what you've done, do you?
He asked. Before I could reply, he made a fist and brought it down hard upon the door. The door was answered after a long moment by a tall, imposing butler with florid cheeks and ramrod posture. He swept us both in a long, cool glance that might have meant anything.
Yes?
He inquired in a tone that perfectly balanced hauteur and politeness. Stoker wordlessly produced a card from the depths of his pocket. The butler looked pained at the lack of card case, and still more grieved at the condition of the card. In Stoker's pocket it had doubtless kept company with bits of string, marbles, for use as eyes in his taxidermic mounts rather than a child's playthings, paper twists of sweets, and the occasional feather collected upon his walks. The butler placed the grubby card upon a silver salver, but it was clear from the change in his manner that he had read it and taken note of the Honourable preceding Stoker's name.
"Shall I direct your compliments to the master or the mistress, Mr. Templeton Vane?"
he inquired.
"Neither. I want to see Mrs. De Morgan."
The butler had been well trained. He gave a politely regretful smile.
"I am sorry to say that Mrs. De Morgan is not at home to call us."
"But she is at home," I pressed. The butler gave nothing away, merely inclined his head and kept his smile fixed. He moved towards us, as if to guide us back through the door.
"I shall, of course, convey the fact of your visit to Mr. and Mrs. Marshwood,"
he began. Stoker drew himself up to his full height and folded his arms over the breadth of his chest.
"I am not leaving. If I cannot see Mrs. De Morgan, kindly arrange for me to see her parents."
"I regret—"
"Not yet, but you will if you don't do as I say,"
Stoker cut in ruthlessly.
"I can smell his bloody cigar smoke from here. Go fetch him and be quick."
The butler flushed, his complexion mottled above the stiff, starched white of his collar.
"Now see here!"
Although things had not yet deteriorated to fisticuffs, the altercation was loud enough to draw the master of the house from his lair. A door just off the entry opened, and a short, barrel-chested man emerged, drawing furiously on his cigar.
"Bowles! What the devil—"
He choked off the last word when he caught sight of Stoker. His ruddy complexion drained of colour, and the cigar slipped from his lips. He caught it with a bare hand, scorching himself, and muttered a curse. He thrust the smouldering stub into his pocket and pointed a plump finger at Stoker.
"I suppose you've come to gloat." "I have done nothing of the sort,"
Stoker said calmly.
"In fact, I might be able to help. I need to see her."
"See her?"
Mr. Marshwood's eyes rounded and he gave a harsh laugh.
"Not bloody likely. Go back to whatever hell pit you crawled from and take your tart with you,"
he added, with a jerk of his chin in my direction. Stoker's hands clenched, but he did not raise them, nor did he move. Instead, he looked down at his former father-in-law, disdain writ clearly upon his features.
"I need to see her,"
he repeated, clipping the words in his most aristocratic tones.
"You need to see her,"
Marshwood mocked, in his decidedly less modulated accent.
You need to go to the devil, is what you need.
He raised a hand, pointing a shaking finger at Stoker.
Remove yourself from my property and do not come back.
He looked to his butler.
Throw him out bodily if he will not go of his own accord.
The butler glanced at Stoker, startled, and Mr. Marshwood grimaced.
Get the lads from the kitchen to help if you cannot manage it on your own.
With that, he turned on his heel and returned to his sanctum, slamming the door behind him. The butler stared at the closed door, then turned slowly to Stoker. He gulped audibly as he surveyed Stoker's inches.
Perhaps we could come to an understanding,
the butler began, pitching his voice low.
What sort of understanding?
I asked, quick to seize the olive branch.
Your companion wishes to see Mrs. De Morgan. It is impossible through the conventional methods, but Mrs. De Morgan does like a turn in the conservatory before her supper,
he said, with a meaningful gesture towards the back of the house. He moved a fraction nearer.
In the wall of the garden is a door. You can find your way from there. Go quietly, and he need never know,
he added, with a lift of his brow at the closed door. Stoker inclined his head graciously and turned to go. The butler sagged in evident relief.
Wise man, I told him. Blood can be devilishly hard to get out of white linen.
The butler closed the door firmly behind us, throwing the bolt instantly. Without a word, Stoker circled the property, leading me through a small mews to the back of the garden. I could just see the roof line of the conservatory, a small affair of wrought iron and glass. It was nothing to the glass house at Bishop's Folly, but the fogged and dripping panes meant it would be warm at least. The street door to the garden was unlocked, and we slipped in, hurrying through the shadows until we reached the conservatory. This, too, was unlocked, the door giving way with a small shriek of the hinges as we entered. Whoever loved this place had a fondness for ferns, for they abounded, draping long green fronds every which way. They had been badly tended. Some were browning, the edges crisp as new taffeta. Others were clearly root-bound, tendrils of white root clawing their way out of the bottoms of the pots. But the heating system worked, pumping steam through the enclosure, and a garden seat had been installed amidst the leafy greenery. It might have been a pleasant place on a sunny day, but in the darkness of a February afternoon past sundown it was oddly unwelcoming. Shadows shifted and stirred, raising little fingers of mist against the blackness outside, and the pipes gave low moans and the occasional shriek as they rattled about their business. Sitting on a garden seat was a woman dressed entirely in white, her gown loose and shapeless, her body wrapped in a woolen shawl that shrouded her to the knees. Her head was bowed over a piece of needlework. Stoker stopped, his gaze fixed upon that head. It gleamed gold in the lamplight, the long tresses unbound except for a small plait around the crown of the head. Her white hands moved smoothly, setting tiny stitches in a rhythm that never varied as she hummed tunelessly. The hair hid her face, but just then my shoe scraped against a pebble, and she looked up, breaking off her song mid-note. If Stoker reacted, I did not notice it. I heard only my own sharp intake of breath as I looked for the first time upon the face of Caroline De Morgan. I had seen her photograph, and I had thought myself prepared. I had taken note of the perfection of her bones, the graceful features which would be beautiful when age had stripped the flesh from them and wrinkled her skin. I had studied the lines of her face and figure, marking each place where nature had favoured her. The list was long. From the arch of her brows to the tips of her tapered fingers, from the curve of her swan neck to the sweet cupid's bow of her lips,
She had been created by a benevolent hand. But what I had not realized, what no photograph could convey, was the pure perfection of her coloring. Her hair was the rich color of summer corn silk, her lashes a fraction darker. Her eyes, but what can one say about such eyes? It would need a poet to do them justice. They were some variety of light blue that would have given a sapphire envy. The irises impossibly wide, with the tiniest of ebony pupils. Roses bloomed in her cheeks against a complexion so fine and white, it would have caused a snowdrop to turn away in shame. Her hands stilled, and she blinked slowly, peering into the leafy shadows.
"Who is there?"
she called. Only the voice lacked perfection. It was high and light, but oddly hoarse. Stoker stepped forwards, and I moved in his wake on unwilling legs. I had forced my way into this meeting, and in that moment I would have sold my soul to a tinker to be anywhere else. Stoker moved into the circle of lamplight, the warm glow settling over his features and illumining his form. Caroline de Morgan raised her face, expressionless as she gazed at her former husband. She blinked twice in obvious puzzlement, then spoke.
"Do I know you?"
Stoker opened his mouth, but not a syllable escaped him. I moved to her, smiling a smile that cost me everything. "Good afternoon. You are Mrs. de Morgan, are you not?" At the sound of her own name, her face puckered in confusion. She looked from me to the pile of needlework in her lap. She lifted her needle and set another stitch.
"Mama says I must not tax my strength,"
she said slowly. "Of course not," I told her. "May I see what you are working on?" I moved past Stoker, for he stood as one turned to stone. I was careful not to move too close to her, for she seemed timid as a doe. Her needle trailed red silk through a large piece of white cloth, and she held it up for me to see. The cloth was uneven at the edges, a rough piece of linen that might once have been used for toweling. Patches here and there had been covered in random stitches, variations on a theme of chaos, no two sections alike. She had stitched at whim, moving from an untidy flame technique to the crooked crosses she made as I watched. "It's very pretty," I told her. I glanced to Stoker, but still he stood, rooted to the spot, his mouth slack in shocked comprehension. I remembered then the hints we had been given about her state. Sir Hugo, Mornaday, even the Tibetans had indicated that she had succumbed to the strain of police questions regarding her husband's disappearance. Sir Hugo had blamed the Dover police for handling her roughly. Little wonder her nerve had broken under the strain. She looked at me, that blue gaze blank as she searched my face.
"Do I know you?"
she repeated. "No, Mrs. de Morgan. My name is Veronica Speedwell," I told her. I darted a glance to Stoker to urge him to come nearer, but he stood at the edge of the ferns, his hands curled into fists.
"Why have you come?"
she asked me. I hesitated, unwilling to deal as brutally with her as the police had done. Stoker moved then, folding his arms over his chest.
"Enough. You might have duped the police with your little performance, but I recognize your amateur theatricals."
She looked up at him, blinking slowly, a vacant look upon her face. Then with an audible sigh she settled back in her chair, her expression entirely lucid.
"What gave me away?"
"You forget I saw your Ophelia. You did the same little trick of wringing the hands,"
he replied,
with a coolness I suspected he did not feel. The beautiful mouth did not smile, but the corners softened ever so slightly.
I did forget. Well, I mayn't have fooled you, but thankfully the men at Scotland Yard are not quite so suspicious.
That's the stratagem, is it? Pretend to be witless, so they will leave you in peace.
Indignation flared in her gaze.
They have been monstrous to me. They think I conspired with John to steal that wretched little crown.
She burst out. To be fair, that is only one of their theories, I corrected. She regarded me with a distinct lack of warmth.
Revelstoke, who is your friend?
Miss Speedwell is my professional associate,
he informed her. She tipped her head to the side, studying me closely.
And something more, I suspect.
Stoker did not rise to the bait.
Is that all you have to say to me?
Her lips thinned.
I suppose you want an apology.
I think we are far beyond that,
he replied.
You could carve out your own heart and offer it up on a platter, and your ledger would still run red.
Her hands curled into fists.
Don't, Revelstoke. I am not proud of what I did, but neither am I as evil as you would like to believe. Malice was never my motivation.
What a consolation that is,
he said, the words sharply edged as any blade.
You may mock me,
she told him evenly.
God knows you have earned the right, but it is the truth. I intended to make you a good wife.
Of all the lies you have ever told me, that, I think, is the most terrible,
he replied. He moved again and she watched him, her expression wary. She lifted her chin in defiance, but I saw from the quickening of the pulse at her throat that she was afraid. He moved slowly, carefully, and she licked her lips as she watched him approach, seemingly unable to tear her gaze from him. Her fingers tightened on the needle in her hand, and I wondered how close he would have to get before she plunged it into his flesh. He stopped, just short of touching her. Without a word, he slipped to his knees before her, his face almost on a level with hers. He tipped his head back, so that the light fell full upon him, exposing the scar that marked him from brow to collar.
I thought you might like to admire another piece of your handiwork, he said,
his voice low and terrible. He nodded towards the needle in her hand.
Did you want to sign it? Go on. There is nothing more you can do to hurt me now. You have already broken the man you knew, crucified every part of my humanity, and left me with nothing except the ruins of what I once was. Why do you look away? Have you developed a conscience? What a burden it must be to you.
He might have gone on. He might have goaded her to plunge the needle into his flesh. He might have taunted her until she fled or broke down weeping. And I would have let him, happily, if it meant causing her pain. I had seen the disgust in her expression as she looked at the scar, the flicker of revulsion that revealed her feelings only too clearly. She regarded him and counted only the damage. I saw only the places where he had stitched himself back together. What repelled her was, to me, the greatest part of him. Every mark that his suffering had left upon him was a mute monument to his strength, the inhuman courage that had caused him to reject death and degradation and every evil with which he had consoled himself on the long journey back from his destruction. He had walked through hellfire and back again, and she saw only the scorch marks, whilst I saw the phoenix. I hated her for that. Oh, let me be honest, I hated her for a thousand reasons, but in that moment
I hated her most of all for the fact that she had the power to hurt him still. He was on his knees before her, lowering himself to revile her, and it was that stripping bare of all his defences that drove me to intercede. She would not hurt him again, I vowed. "Did you kill your husband, Mrs. De Morgan?" I asked, my voice sharper and louder than I intended. Instantly, their heads swiveled to me. Caroline De Morgan's mouth went slack, and she gave a little cry of protest, bringing her hands up. Stoker's gaze was empty a moment. Then his eyes seemed to focus, and he wrenched himself back into the present, seeing me where a moment before. But who can say what devils he conjured in his mind's eye? Was he thinking of her as she had been? An innocent bride whose altar-blessed lips he had kissed before she had left him for dead. I could not bear to think of it. He forced himself to his feet as Caroline De Morgan addressed me, her voice cold with rage.
"How dare you? That is the most monstrous suggestion."
"Is it?" I asked mildly. "Reports of the state of your marriage indicate that it was not entirely happy."
"It was, it is, perfectly happy," she insisted angrily. "John loves me and I love him, and if we quarrel sometimes it is only because we are neither of us temperate. Ours is a marriage of great passion," she said, breaking off as she looked at Stoker. "I don't understand why you have come, tormenting me with questions."
"We have come because we are investigating your husband's whereabouts," I returned.
"Investigating? And who are you that you should do the business of the police?"
she demanded. "I do not feel inclined to explain our interest in the matter, but if you will not speak to the police, you ought to speak to us. Surely you wish to uncover the mystery to your husband's disappearance?" I let my voice trail away suggestively.
"Surely I wish."
She mimicked my tone with sharp cruelty.
"How cold you are. You can stand there and discuss the greatest tragedy of my life as dispassionately as if I had misplaced a latchkey. You are the most unnatural woman I have ever met."
The tightness in my chest eased a little. I had successfully directed her venom to me instead of Stoker, and I hoped a few minutes' respite were enough to enable him to gather his dignity and his temper once more. "You might imagine the insult to be original," I told her, baring my teeth in a smile. "You would be wrong. Now, the police seem to favour the theory that your husband stole the diadem and made away with it in order to leave his marriage and make a new start, perhaps in America. Do you have any proof that he did not?" She gave me a look of purest loathing before her mouth curved into a mirthless smile.
"Do I have proof? Yes, Miss Speedwell. I have proof that my husband loved me, proof that he would never abandon me."
She put aside her needlework and rose slowly to her feet, letting the knitted shawl drop to the ground. Her figure was obviously slight, but she put her hands protectively to her thickened middle, pulling her gown taut over the ripe, rounded belly.
"There is your proof, Miss Speedwell," she said, her voice ringing in triumph. "He would never abandon his son."
We stood, the three of us, in a sort of frozen tableau. I did not look at Stoker to assess his reaction. I dared not. Before I could form a response, the door to the house was flung back and a lady entered. She had clearly just arrived, for she was still dressed for an afternoon outing, in rusty black from head to toe. The wing of a blackbird had been mounted upon her hat, and the effect, when combined with her aggressive profile, was one of arrested motion, a vulture preparing to take flight. I disliked her instantly, although I could not have said why apart from her appalling taste in millinery. Around her neck was some variety of weasel or stoat, dyed black to mimic mink, its bright glass bead eyes staring balefully at me as she advanced.
She took in the scene with a glance, sweeping her gaze from me to Stoker and then to Caroline. Without a word to either of us, she turned to Caroline.
"You oughtn't upset yourself, my dear. Go and rest in your room until the dressing bell."
For an instant, Caroline looked as if she would have liked to